Good evening and welcome to an Author's First radio special right here on the Artist First Radio Network. Richie K in Studio A here tonight. And tonight my guest will be RJ Reaver, the author of Elliot. It's a new story about Roswell. And we're going to get right into it with RJ. How are you doing tonight?
I'm fine. How are you, Richie?
Welcome to the show. I'm doing great.
I am so pleased to be here with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. The new book is called Elliot, The Return to Roswell. And can you tell us just a little bit about what inspired you to write the book?
I originally wrote this as a screenplay because I've worked in Hollywood for probably over 20 years. And I was trying to get a script into DreamWorks Productions. And I happened to be talking with a vice president of development over there. And basically, I didn't have anything that he needed. And after he had looked at, he liked different scripts that I had, but he couldn't do anything with those. So I went to bed one night, and basically I asked God that I said I needed something marketable because I've written a lot of spiritually inspired New Age kind of screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
And so my stuff has, you know, interdimensional things and crystal caves and all kinds of, different kinds of stuff. That this guy did not know how to market that at the time. This was back in 2006. And so I woke up the next morning with this idea for Elliot in my mind. And I actually had the opening sequence where... because it starts with, and the book starts this way as well, with these two aliens in a spacecraft. It's a comedy, or a dramedy, I guess they call it, where these two aliens are coming to Earth on a mission, and their spacecraft is malfunctioning, and they start being pursued by the military, and they end up crashing in a farm in a field outside of Roswell, New Mexico. And the year is 2012. It's July 7th, 2012, when they crash. So it takes the original 1947 Roswell incident, and it updates it and brings it into our current time frame. And what takes place is a 10-year-old girl sees the crash from her bedroom window on her ranch, and the next morning two strange men, human looking men, show up at her house in her kitchen talking to her mom, and this little girl knows that these two have to be from that alien spacecraft that she saw crashing, but of course nobody believes her. So the story takes off and we have to find out if these are good aliens or bad aliens and if they get caught or not. And
only the child knows.
That's it. She knows instinctively. What she saw was a fireball. So it could have been a meteor. But and that's what the news is playing it as, is a meteor. The theme of it, what really was coming forward to me as I was writing it, was the idea, the concept that what would it take for anybody to believe that aliens are real and that UFOs are real? Because we now live in such a technological age, and we can do things so easily, special effects so easily on computers, on home computers now, that what would it take for people to actually believe that what they were seeing was real?
Right, even in the age of video cameras, the camera could lie.
Yeah, that's it. And originally, one of my favorite films was The Day the Earth Stood Still, the the original black and white 1950s one. I like the second one as well, but and that first one dealt with that idea of the way the alien proved that he really was an alien was he stopped all electrical devices on the planet for half an hour on one day, and that was the day the Earth stood still. And that's when everybody really believed he really is from another planet and has, you know, great superior technology. But these days here, we wouldn't necessarily believe that if somebody stopped it. We'd say they set off an EMP device. So that wouldn't necessarily mean that they were from another planet.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I see. So you've kind of updated a lot of traditional sci-fi kind of elements into the modern era in the story, dealing with new questions that could arise with the first contact.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also the idea that all aliens don't have to be evil or nefarious, that there can be some that are actually just doing their jobs.
There's been a few movies kind of like that. I know, I mean, E.T. was first that comes to mind.
Yeah.
With a happy-go-lucky, yeah, nice
and,
alien.
Yeah, and this is very similar in the sense also that with E.T., it all took place here on Earth, and it involved some kids. And this is like a 2012 hats off to E.T.
I see.
I would put it that way.
So you actually you wrote this as a screenplay originally and then adapted it to a novel, or vice versa?
Yeah, okay. I wrote it as a screenplay first, and then a couple years later, actually about 4 years later, put it out as a... as a book.
That probably doesn't happen too often in the...
I don't think it does.
...writing world.
Yeah. And I found that I really enjoyed the book more, even more than the screenplay, because I could go much more in-depth with the characters and the situations. Because with a screenplay, you're limited to 90 minutes to 120, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And...
So you kind of fleshed out the story a little more?
Yeah,
gave
it was
some
great.
More detail?
It's great. It's the characters just really come to life in a way that they wouldn't necessarily on screen, because they'll come to life inside of you when you're reading the book by the descriptions and the thought processes that they're going through.
And has the movie ever been made, or was it originally... Is this the first time people will be able to get exposure to the story?
This is the first time people will get exposure to the story. Because
okay.
The story... I'm shopping. I'm currently shopping the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
But the story, the book, is now available.
So you've been in Hollywood now for a little while. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your experiences just leading up to the writing of the book and also just before that? And what got you to be here and where you are today?
I started in the payroll department of Aaron Spelling Productions in television like way long ago. And worked on things like Charlie's Angels, Heart to Heart.
On the original series?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Just wondering.
I know, it's probably too much information.
Well, there was Charlie's Angels was, redone on the movie.
Yeah, that's just a few years ago,
so yeah. I wasn't sure.
That's right. That's true. It was. Yeah, Drew Barrymore did that. I worked with Drew on... a film that she did called Mad Love, that she and Chris O'Donnell were in that together, and that was probably 15 years ago. And Chris now is on CSI.
Right, Chris O'Donnell.
And NCSI? Is that what the name? The
NCIS, right?
NCIS, there you go. Okay. There you go. All those acronyms.
How do you keep them straight?
Yeah. So, but I came into Hollywood through, I was an English literature major in college. I went to UC Santa Cruz. And I ended up in Hollywood through a strange series of events that, because I happened to know somebody who was a Teamster, and he got me an interview in the accounting department at Aaron Spelling, and for some reason I got that job, and it set me into the Hollywood zone of learning how films are made and meeting people. Eventually I ended up doing accounting on feature films, high-budget feature films, like Volcano was one of them. I don't know if you remember that one. The Galaxy Quest. Did you ever see Galaxy Quest?
Well, that's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, that's most people. That was my favorite too. And I did Dreamgirls. I worked on Transformers 2. And all of that work was accounting. I was doing construction accounting. So I learned a lot about building things, building sets, and how films are, how they come together. It's a real communal process, movie making.
That's why the credits roll for so long at
That's
the end.
That's it. That's absolutely it. I think Volcano had about 2,500 people involved, and if you look at those credits, it's a really long. And Transformers 2 would have been the same or more, because they also now run all the credits of the graphic companies that do all the CGI stuff.
So you were keeping track of money for 2,500 people.
I was keeping track of money for about 200 people on the construction crew itself.
Wow.
Yeah, and then there were bunches of other accountants handling other areas of the...
They have the so film. Much that they have to have more than one accountant deal with one project.
Yeah, the high-budget films tend to have... well, they can have 10 or 15 or 20 people in the accounting department. Right. Depends how big the movie is.
Well, it makes sense, especially with a high-budget movie where you've got tons of actors and just the crew and everything. You're probably handling payroll and then just expenses for the film and sets and everything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're trying to spend all that money, hundreds of millions of dollars in a matter of, say, 9 months.
Wow.
And so to keep track of all that expense and all that money going out takes a lot of people, a lot of accountants.
Mm-hmm. And they're probably depending on you to make sure they don't go over budget, huh?
Yeah, that's what the accountant's job is definitely to... just be the flag warning person that says, okay, if you keep spending at this amount for this long, you have this many days left of money.
Right.
Yeah.
So this got you in the door and experience on a lot of Hollywood productions. I can just imagine you learned a tremendous amount.
Absolutely. I got to read all the scripts that we were shooting, and so I learned a lot about screenwriting. I took classes on that as well, and my background in English literature is what informs all my characters and plot development and theme and all of that. But I also, what I found with writing Elliot was how much I enjoy the medium of novels, because then it's just me and the page, and the characters can come through me. Where when you're doing screenplays, you're locked up for a while writing the script, but then once the script goes out to get shot, There's a whole bin you have, like, you know, you can have anywhere from 30 people on low-budget films to 2,500 people on high-budget films involved in creating, turning that into something else, into the movie. So it's not as, it's not an intimate process the way that writing, the writing process itself is a very sweet, intimate process with the characters and the story.
It probably in a lot of ways more kind of spiritually connective.
Yeah, it is. I'm a Buddhist, and I was raised a Christian, and I do believe in Jesus, and I also know all the stuff in Buddhism, and I've studied other religions as well, and the common point in most world religions comes back to this comes back to love and loving kindness and compassion. That we can be the best human beings we can be when, and show the most elegance and grace when we can move from the place in our heart that is propelled by love. And this book, this particular book, Elliot, is it wrote itself through me. That's the way that I describe it. Because I wrote it in a matter of weeks, and it was just such a joy to write because it was alive on its own, and you'll see when you read it that it's like the characters just leap off the page and they just start running, and they take you on a great adventure.
That's really awesome. And you mentioned at the beginning of the interview that it was after a kind of prayer that you were inspired to write the book.
Yeah, that was it.
And then it just came right out all at once.
All at once, just whoosh, and it's like, wow. Yeah.
You should do that every day, huh?
Yeah, I do, I try to.
That's really awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
I've interviewed a lot of people, and one common thread that seems to come up with writing is that there's a lot of people that say that it is like coming through them, like
yeah.
you mentioned.
Yeah, it's true. I know over the years as I've been writing that, because I've written most of my life, and when I took classes when I was back in high school and college, and you need the classes, you need to understand the structure of things and how to flesh out characters and all those basic elements. But once you've learned all those elements, there comes a point where you let go of that structure and you reach, there's a deeper level where it does just start coming through. If you allow it to, if you can get your ego out of the way. And that's where the Buddhist meditation stuff has worked very well for me, where that helped me a lot to really quiet my mind and just listen. Because I think good writing really is about listening. And I think actors actually say that acting is really about listening. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that before.
Do you find a lot of parallels between kind of religious philosophies and creative people in general?
I do. I do, at least with the ones that I run into in the when I go to. I'm a member of the Agape International Spiritual Center. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of writers and musicians at that church, and all of them, everybody pretty much, we talk in the same style of that there's this power that channels through you, that it, when you relax enough with it, it can flow through, and it's a totally different experience in creativity mm-hmm. when you're relaxed with it and allow it to just have its way with you, basically, than when you're trying to force something based on ideas from the news or from, you know, based on structures and that you're, yeah, it's a very different, experience.
I've found that with music, you can have a similar experience just from knowing, you know, learning the basics is like you said, you know, it takes some years of training to get to the point where it could just be like that, but then it becomes almost just a fluid extension of your consciousness.
Yeah, that's it. I have goosebumps while you're saying that because, yeah, music, I've always admired musicians because it seems to me that music is an even more pure distillation of that divine energy than words. Although words, if when I've I do Tibetan Buddhist meditation and chanting at points, and the Tibetan chanting, when you don't know the language. When it's not your natural language, and it can sound just like pure sound as you're chanting, mm-hmm. you get lost in the, you can have more epiphanies that way, I think.
Right.
And actually, I think in the old Roman Catholic Church, when the liturgy was given in Latin back in the, well, before they went to English, I think Joseph Campbell talked about this, how the priest would have his back to the congregation and be chanting, saying the liturgy in Latin, and it creates an energetic field within the church congregation so that the congregants themselves, because they don't know the language, they can get caught in the rhythm of the sound. And it can take you into, it shifts your brain into a different, probably into theta waves, if science looked at it. And that's where you can access these larger dynamic fields of consciousness.
Mm. That's so awesome. I've thought of so many things while you're talking there. We could go in so many different directions.
Yeah, let's go.
One I thought was the connection between language and music is kind of close, you know, in that, you know, it's kind of, it is a sound-based medium, you know, spoken language anyway.
Yeah.
So we're talking, you know, and we're coming up with the words that we're saying as we're going along. In the same way you could be having a conversation with other musicians, you know, playing a song. And improvising together, you know. So there's these like connections between language and music, and they've actually done some scientific studies where they've found that the same parts of your brain are activated. So like children who learn music at a young age have like an easier aptitude with learning foreign languages.
Oh, cool!
And things like that.
Yeah.
So like I've seen that to be true from what you were saying as
yeah.
well. And,
yeah.
and then the kind of aspect where you went into talking about the sort of inexplicable aspect of music in relation to, you know, like taking the conceptual out of the language and
yeah.
turning it into pure sound.
Yeah, turning it into pure sound.
It does something to our brain that we like
it does it,
that not knowing or something is almost like trusting in like this knowing flow that's beyond us.
Yeah, and I think it must access the right side or somehow, because I honestly think I know there's been lots of predictions about 2012 and December 21st and a lot of prophecies from, you know, ancient past that have spoken to the coming events, supposedly, that none of us knows what, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, for, you know, let alone, you know, by the end of the year or 10 years from now. But But I do think something that seems to be happening in our consciousness, in our evolution of consciousness, is we're, as a collective humanity, we're attempting to balance both sides of our brains to get the brain to function in a new way. As I think we've been more focused on left brain thinking, especially here in the United States, for a very long period. It's all that logical reasoning thing. And it sort of did not allow the right side of the brain to really show off its full potential. And I think now, because of so many people are practicing meditation or moved into prayer in different forms, even if it's if it isn't in church, if it's in for some reason I'm thinking of men laying cement, pouring cement, that when they use those trowels and they're smoothing it, that any,
it's like the act of work that is kind of thoughtless almost, but just gets you into a trance-like state or something.
Yeah, gets you into that zone where the brain, I think it actually hits a resonance of synchronicity in itself, and that allows. Now I'm flashing on a whole bunch of things. It allows the energy to flow through much more easily and in a much larger way. There's a film that was called Black Hole that has a guy named Nassim Haramein in it. It's a documentary. Nassim Haramein, I would say, is the current day Albert Einstein. He's a physicist who has basically come up with a unified field theory that he is currently teaching, and you can get his stuff online. He goes around and does a lot of speaking tours too, I think. I think in something I saw him in, one of the films that I saw him in discussing this stuff, there was made mention the fact that human beings ages ago, whether it was in Atlantis or, you know, I think the Hopi Indians talk about the four worlds of humanity, that we're the fourth race of humans to come forward out of the earth, I think that, and because there have been ice ages and other things that have wiped out, you know, the previous three groupings. But the first races, there seems to be indications, and this goes into the idea that yes, we actually come from alien DNA sort of stuff, and mm-hmm. that there have been other more advanced cultures on the planet, on Earth, before we showed up.
Zacharias Itchen, Eric Von Doniggin, those guys.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, okay. That kind of stuff. And Sitchin especially, the 12th planet.
I've read all that stuff.
I figured you would. Yeah, that's good. Thank you. So you know. But the image that was in this film was a human being who had an auric field, an energetic field that was 360 degrees in all directions. It was so full and complete that it was a fully activated human being. I guess you could call it that, where they were using all of their senses, including, ESP, levitation, all of these things. They could see things totally differently, sort of like the guy in The Matrix.
Neo,
or yeah, when he finally realizes he is the one.
Right.
And he becomes one with the larger mind, and he can see them, the computer programming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not limited by his perception of people. He sees the actual program.
Right.
And then still can interact with it. We have those potentials, I guess, is what this Nassim Haramein was talking about at one point. And that's what we're trying to grow into those, I think, as a species. And hopefully, if we don't destroy ourselves before we reach that point, we will actually. Because I think even Jesus said something in the Bible about this you shall do and more mm-hmm. than what he did, in terms of being able to transform, you know, water into wine, and, you know, feed hundreds of people with a few loaves of bread, and all the miracles that were talked about with him. He himself said that we had that potential, and even more, because he recognized it's not the ego that's making that happen. It's that divine power, the same power that, as it writes through you as the artist or plays through you as the musician, it's that divine source that's actually creating all of the miracles. It's not the little ego that's labeled.
I hope you're right.
So-and-so, you know?
I hope he's right.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Wouldn't that be nice? It would be a whole different planet if we could all relax and get along, you know?
Have you ever heard of there's a French film called The Green Beautiful?
Oh, no. The Green Beautiful?
Yeah, it's awesome. And there's it's about this alien race that they look just like humans, but they just live on this planet that's like perfect. And it's just like flowing green hills everywhere.
Oh, wow.
And they actually can like transport to other planets in their mind and stuff.
Oh, cool.
And they have all these strange powers that we don't have. But they nobody ever wants to go to Earth.
Of course.
But they've sent a few, you know, like Bach.
Okay. Yeah, like, I could see that. I could see that with Bach.
Yeah, right. Like, so it's really a cool movie. You should check it out sometime.
I will check it out.
It just kind of reminded me of it. Some of the things you were talking about.
Yeah.
I really would like to, you know, see a world where we have, you know, developed ourselves spiritually and emotionally to the point where we can be free of war and all these petty struggles over religion, you know, the kind of Star Trek, you know, ideal.
Yeah.
I think it's so possible.
But it's
sometimes so hard to... maybe in Hollywood, it's a little easier to believe in the the possible, rather than the obvious.
Yeah, that very well could be true because.
But we're here in Ohio, we got a lot of.
Yeah, and now it's a
BS
harder edge there. Yeah, well, you have harsh winters too.
Right.
You know, when you're getting smacked in the face with 100 feet of snow or something, it's like, well. You know, that is a different reality.
You came from Ohio.
I did. I was only spent about a year and a half to 2 years there. I was born in Ohio State University Hospital, so I'm a Buckeye baby.
Okay.
And I always watched the Ohio-Michigan game, football game. That's the one football game I make sure that I see.
That is a big game.
Yeah. My family, my mom and my dad were born and raised in Ohio, and there was a at one point, I don't know if it's still there, Reaver Lane is where my dad was born, in a house on Reaver Lane where his parents lived, and all the Reavers were there.
So when did the Reavers go to California?
Well, my dad and mom, they came out here in the late 50s, and my sister, who's older, was born first. Then they came out here for, my dad is an electronics engineer, he's retired, and the NASA, I guess the JPL, NASA, the whole space thing started happening. Which is why I'm probably writing a sci-fi novel. So he came out here for work. Then he went back to Columbus. They went back for about a year or 2 years, and I was born in Ohio then. And then we moved back out here again, I think, for my father's business.
He worked for NASA?
He worked for, I can't remember the first ones that he worked for. He ended up at a company called Datametrics, and they did the Ranger rockets were the first rockets that were shot at the moon and crashed into the face of the moon, but were taking pictures all the way in as they were crashing because they were trying to get shots to see where it would be safe for the lunar modules to land. And my father was, his business was one company that was involved in, it wasn't the camera, it was the, it might have been something as simple as the circuit that clicked the camera so that it would automatically be taking these pictures as it came into the moon. Yeah, so I like to tell my dad periodically that his fingerprints are on the moon, but because, you know, he handled stuff in a, he was actually, I think, a vice president of Datametrics for a while. But the Reavers themselves, the Reaver heritage, is all in airplanes. They were all pilots, except for my dad. He was the black sheep going into electronics. And my uncle was a pilot for American Airlines for a very long time. And my uncle Stanley, though, he flew, he was also, as in addition to being a regular pilot, he also did stunt pilot work in the film industry and in the original James Stewart Spirit of 76 movie, Spirit of St. Louis, about...
Amelia Earhart?
Lindbergh.
Oh, Lindbergh.
Lindbergh flying across the ocean or something. But he flew the stunt scenes in that film. And there was a, he told me a story once about almost the director kept yelling at him, fly lower, because he had to, when Lindbergh first took off in the Spirit of St. Louis, he almost crashed because the wheels of the plane almost hit these telephone lines at the edge of the field. And so Uncle Stan had to fly the plane in the film close enough to look like he almost hit the wires. Well, he actually did hit the wire, and his plane nosedived over into a field on the other side of this, you know, field they were using. So you can see if you watch the movie, there's a slight bounce in the wires. They didn't, in the editing, they then showed him flying upward as opposed to crashing on the other side.
But you can still see just the bounce of the wire.
You can see a little bounce on the wire.
Wow.
In the black and white film, it's like, whoa.
What do they call that when just those little tiny errors are noticeable in a film?
Oh, yeah, those are,
Continuity?
Continuity, that's right, script continuity.
That would hurt.
Yeah.
I always look for that.
Those are good. Yeah.
That would have been a tough one to catch, I think.
I think it would. I didn't see it until my uncle told me the story, and then I looked
for
it.
But he was okay.
He was fine. Yeah, he was fine. He was annoyed with the director, but...
oh, I bet. Okay. They're like, just go lower,
yeah.
Go lower.
Yeah, so...
I can't get you in the shot. He doesn't care if you crash.
Yeah, that's it.
You're just the stunt guy.
We've got to get the shot before the light goes down.
I was like, you're going to die eventually anyway. This movie's going to live forever.
That's right.
Can you read a little portion of your book?
Oh, I would love to.
We're talking right now to R.J. Reaver. She's the author of Elliot, The Return to Roswell. And this is her first published novel. We're going to hear an excerpt from it. Also, while we're waiting for her to queue up the section to read, why don't you listeners out there check out www.rjreaver.com. And that's R-E-A-V-E-R, rjreaver.com. And you can learn a little bit about her. And is the book available there to purchase?
You can click on the front page of that website and of the Elliot, the Return to Roswell.com website. There are links that take you to Amazon.com, to the page there that sells the book.
So So available on Amazon and Kindle.
And Kindle, yeah.
The book is Elliot, The Return to Roswell. And are you ready?
Oh, I am ready.
Okay, we're going to hear a segment then from this, so listen closely.
Okay. The chapter is titled The Wish. As she sat on her bed in the darkness of her upstairs room and peered through the binoculars that her father had left behind when he abandoned her and her mother 5 years before, Grace Tyler felt every hair on her arms and the back of her neck stand up when the fireball appeared in the skies a few miles from her ranch house just outside Roswell. "Awesome!" Gracie exclaimed as she jumped off her bed and ran to her window, to her windowsill to get a better view of the fiery object streaking low across the sky. All of her life, Gracie had wanted to see a real live UFO. And while her time on Earth was not really that long, she had just turned 10 4 weeks before. Now that her wish was coming true, Grace felt conflicted. She loved the thrill of watching the fireball plummeting to Earth. She sincerely hoped that its inhabitants were safe. But before she could decide how she really felt about actually meeting extraterrestrials, the fireball crashed into a faraway field on the other side of the ridge. Instantly, Gracie dashed down the upstairs hallway to her mother's room. Not stopping to think, Gracie burst into her mother's room and leapt onto the bed as she shouted, "Mom! Mom! The aliens have landed!" At the mere sound of her daughter's voice yelling, Annie Tyler's 35-year-old body automatically shot itself full of adrenaline as she bolted up out of a very deep sleep. "What?" Annie shouted as she got her bearings. Seeing Grace, she grabbed her arms and said, "Honey, are you okay?" "Mom!" Gracie shouted as she grabbed her mother's arms and tried to pull her out of bed. "A UFO! It crashed out there!" As her brain processed this information, Annie's autonomic nervous system immediately sent out the all-clear message, and adrenaline production instantly ceased, causing Annie's body to yawn loudly and collapse back into the bed. "Gracie, sweetie, you know how much I love you, but didn't you just have this same dream last week?" Gracie tried to pull her mother up again. "Yeah, Mom, but this isn't a dream. Honest, I was watching the whole thing out of my window with Dad's binoculars." Upon hearing Gracie mention her father, Annie woke up again and looked into her 10-year-old daughter's eyes. They stared back at her in all earnestness. "It looked like a huge fireball," Gracie continued, tugging at her mother's arm, "and it crashed out by the Miller Ranch." Recognizing defeat, Annie wheeled her body out of bed and peered out her bedroom window with her daughter. The landscape was black and serene. It looked like every other summer night in Roswell when the moon was waxing and nearly full. Annie put her hands on Gracie's shoulders. "Okay, young lady," her calm, motherly voice began. "It's time for you to go to bed." "But, Mom!" Annie's grip tightened on her daughter's shoulders as she turned the youngster around and stared into her eyes. "No, enough," Annie said calmly. "I don't care if the Martians have landed out there. I have got to get some sleep, and so do you." She walked her daughter back over to the bed. "Besides, you can't see anything out there, and if something did crash, it will be all over the news tomorrow." Gracie stared at her mother's big bed. "Can't I sleep in my room?" "No." Annie pulled the covers down for her daughter to climb in. "If there are aliens out there, I'll need you to wake me up if they try to take over the ranch." Annie stared seriously at Gracie. Gracie rolled her eyes and muttered, "Oh, brother," as she crawled into her mother's bed. Annie grinned as she climbed into her bed and pulled her daughter in close. She missed snuggling with her daughter. They hadn't snuggled like this in over a year. Maybe it wasn't so bad if the Martians were invading, Annie thought. If it brings her daughter closer to her, what would be the harm in that? And on that thought, Annie drifted back into sleep. As soon as she heard her mother's soft, steady snore, Gracie sat up enough in bed to look out her mother's window. She couldn't see the ground. Basically, she couldn't see anything. "Oh, brother," Gracie thought, "I never get to have any fun." She finally lay back down and snuggled up against her mother and listened to her mother's soft, rhythmic snore. Even though she was 10 years old and had learned to take care of herself, Gracie's body relaxed the most when she could fall asleep listening to that particular sound. Outside in the darkness, a military convoy drove silently through the night to the crash site. And that's the end of that chapter.
Ooh, the aliens are back in Roswell.
They're back. And this time we've got video. That's the catch on the back of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. But can you believe what you see on the video?
That's it. That's the other question.
And do we get to know the aliens much in your book?
We do. We do. We get to know them quite well, and we get to love them quite well. Yeah.
Well, that's exciting in itself.
Yeah.
I always get disappointed in these movies where there's an alien, and then they just kind of disappear back to where they came from and just leave us alone now forever.
Yeah, yeah, no. And as a matter of fact, I'm working on a sequel to this that will end up. I have a feeling there's going to be quite a few books with these characters. Because they have so much life and vitality, and that it will take place on this planet, but also on other planets and interdimensionally as well. Because that's a whole other area that we don't we're just really coming into with quantum physics and the idea of space portals and that these UFOs can be they can be moving in and out of dimensions that we just don't understand yet. We don't know how to access quite yet.
Kind of raising the angels or aliens question.
Yeah, yeah. And I do believe in angels, too. I guess the thing I think that's important is for people to recognize that that there are UFOs and there are aliens, that from everything I've been studying with all this stuff, but that they're just like us, and there is also something... there is also God, or whatever you want to call that divine, all-powerful, all-loving source that's all-knowing and everywhere. That just because there's extraterrestrials doesn't mean... Because I know in those great Star Trek, Stargate, Stargate Atlantis, and the Stargate SG-1... in those series, and how they have shown the ideas that aliens have visited and they were looked at like gods, and but that doesn't deny the fact that there is God, but
just that what we thought was God
was not. Yeah.
But then the whole concept of the sort of the one God, I guess, that is not visible, is still there. So you don't have to kind of abandon your belief system to believe in aliens.
Yeah, no, you don't have to believe in anything. this is a novel, so this is. I just, as I was writing it, it wrote through me, and I've always been interested in a sci-fi fan. But when I started, I think it was Ancient Aliens when that started on the History Channel. And we just had the internet's given us so much more access to stories of real people experiencing real things and not being able to explain those things easily. And also the people in Roswell who were there and living during 1947 when the first cover-up took place, that there's been so many of them coming forward. If you go to R.J. Reaver, if you go to Elliot, the return to Roswell.com, there's a page called UFO Facts. On the bottom of that page, it starts with a DVD by James Fox called I Know What I Saw. That DVD has in it military generals and military government officials all talking about their experiences with UFOs. And I think he also has alien extraterrestrial contact stories in there as well. If you go further down the page, there's a couple of books on UFOs. And on the bottom, there's a press conference, a national press conference that just took place last September. It might have been September 2010. In that press conference, it's, I think, about 8 different retired military men talking about UFO experiences that they had while they were in the military, and how things got covered over. There's a colonel from Bentwaters, RAF Bentwaters, and another guy from RAF Bentwaters, a staff sergeant who had named Jim Peniston, I think is his last name. Jim was on the current season of Ancient Aliens, talking about the spacecraft that he saw. This was in a London, a U.S. Air Base, Air Force Base, back in 1986, that he saw land in the forest outside. It was a triangular craft, and it was on the ground. He actually went up and touched that thing. And when he touched it, he got a download of information of ones and zeros. And it changed his whole life. He was, at the time that happened, he was probably in his early 20s, and just a regular guy. That whole experience upset his entire life, and he's been recovering from that since then. And he talks about it in that his History Channel Ancient Alien.
Did it upset his life mainly because he was
trying to prove it and process it? I guess for about 30, from the time it happened until just now, just when the season started, he didn't tell it. He had kept this notebook that what he wrote down with these ones and zeros, and the ones and zeros, he finally found a computer guy that just punched all the numbers into a program.
Oh, he remembered them.
Yeah, it's like right after the thing happened in the 86, he went back to his barracks, I guess, and wrote it all down he wrote 6 pages of these ones and zeros that he kept in a notebook that he hid and just held on to for 30 years because he didn't want to tell anybody about it because it freaked him out. And he didn't know what it meant, because it was just ones and zeros.
So what's it mean? What's it mean?
What it ended up meaning was, I know I should have this by memorized, but I don't. But wait.
Oh, no.
I do have on my iPhone, I took a picture of the TV screen when they had this on the History Channel. And let me see if I can find it in here. Because
it's
gave
like a picture of Barbara Streisand or something, isn't it? The aliens just want you to know this.
That's it.
Well, it
ended up with this computer guy when he talks about it on that. It's anybody can access this by getting the first episode of this season's Ancient Aliens, because the guy's in that one. And he, the computer guy didn't think it would amount to anything, but he punched all the numbers in, and it turned out on a, this is what it said. It says, exploration of humanity. Then it gives a longitude and latitude, north and west. Then it says, continuous for planetary advance. That's what the message was. The longitude and latitude it gave is actually off the, I think, the British Isle, in the ocean, near the coast, where it is said that there was an island that sank, centuries ago, and there were the myths at the time were that there were people on the island who were kept to themselves. They didn't go to the mainland much because they thought the mainland people were kind of barbaric, and they were more advanced. That's the lore of that island before this thing ever came out on Ancient Aliens.
You should come on our show, Project Urantia, sometime, where Michael is actually channeling aliens, and he just comes up with the most amazing stuff.
Oh, wow.
And we've got a pretty good listenership, a lot of people tuning in on the network who are interested in this subject.
Oh, cool.
Which is like all about the kind of confluence between UFO and spirituality. And there's just, I think, a lot of people in a growing community of searchers out there.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, too. I know at Agape Church that I go to, I'm part of their, I'm a member of the Peace Ministry. And we're working with interfaith groups to help promote the consciousness of peace. And one of these groups that we interrelate with is called the Aetherius Society, and they are they do channeling of extraterrestrials. I guess they were founded by a fellow named George King back in the 50s, I think. And he was yeah, you could look them up, the Aetherius Society, if you don't.
Okay,
yeah.
I will.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for coming on. We've got 2 minutes left.
Oh, man, okay. I could talk all day.
This has just gone by so fast. And again, can you remind our listeners the best place where they can find Elliot, The Return to Roswell, and more about you?
Oh, it's Elliot, The Return to Roswell, and you can either go to, you can get it on Amazon or Kindle, or you can go to my website, rjreaver.com, and there's a link to the Amazon or Kindle there. And also you can find it at ElliotTheReturnToRoswell.com. That website also has the link over to Amazon and Kindle. I'm RJ Reaver.
RJ, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Richie.
Richie, yep.
Richie. Yes.
Have a great time, and I hope wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. You too.
Okay, take care.
You've been listening to Authors First on the Artist First Radio Network. Stay tuned. We've got a music show coming up next.